Paul. And first up, I'd like to introduce the page that will be working with the Civil Law Committee. Would you stand? It's Allison. Alicia. Alicia. And she's been assigned to just our committee, so we're pretty happy. Ms. Vaught's really happy to have her own page instead of sharing like last year. So welcome to the committee. And I gave her a test today. So nobody here at the table reveal whether or not you're a lawyer or not. And at the end of the committee hearing, I'm going to ask her to identify which one of us she thinks are attorneys and which one are not. So we'll see. No. No. Okay, the next item on our agenda is approval of the minutes from the meeting on January 28th. Representative Lippman moves approval. Any additions or corrections? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Motion is approved. The next item on our agenda, I believe, is House File 1805. Representative Pugh, I believe you requested to go first.
Let him go ahead.
And there was, later on in the agenda, we have House File 898. There's been some controversy around that bill. We will hear the bill, and then that bill will be laid on the table and will be brought back up at the beginning of the committee hearing a week from today. And I've talked to the author. He's fine with that. So people that want to testify for or against it will hear the testimony, but we're not going to take action on House File 898 today. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The bill that I have before you today, Madam Chair, and I guess I should move that it be approved and recommended to pass. And I don't believe it has to go to any other committee, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, the bill that I have before you today, House File 1805, is a bill relating to real estate law and mortgages, satisfactions of mortgages. We're probably all familiar with mortgages. I don't know how many of us are familiar with paying off a mortgage, and that's what we're talking about today. I'm not old enough to have reached that plateau yet in life, but assuming I do, I may encounter a problem, as a lot of individuals in our state and a lot of small businesses have encountered a problem, and that is once they've paid off the mortgage, they receive, usually in the mail, a satisfaction of mortgage. It's a document that says the mortgage is paid in full and that the mortgage company is releasing any interest they have in the property. Unfortunately, it has become very common in Minnesota and other states throughout the country for mortgages to be assigned. The original lender may transfer the mortgage, sell the mortgage to another company. That may actually be done a number of times before you pay off your mortgage. In the end, you may end up with a piece of paper that's signed by a company satisfying your mortgage, but if someone looks in the records at the county, they will not recognize the name of the signer. It's not going to be the same company that you originally had your mortgage with. This bill attempts to resolve that problem for homeowners and for small businesses by allowing for the recording of a satisfaction by the ultimate assignee of the mortgage. I have with me today Chuck Parsons, who can explain the bill and how it works technically. He is from the Minnesota Bar Association. He's the head of its real estate section. He has worked on this language with other real estate lawyers, with lenders, and with other companies who are interested in this problem. Madam Chair, if I could, I'd have Mr. Parsons walk us through the bill.
Thank you, Representative Pugh. Mr. Parsons, if you'd state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
I'm an attorney licensed in the state of Minnesota, and I'm here on behalf of the Real Property Law Section of the Minnesota State Bar Association.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Representative Pugh did such a good job explaining this bill, I'm not sure what I could add. It is a problem that we get satisfactions, and we can't tie the party signing it with the party who has the mortgage in the record. This will solve that problem as long as they say in the form of satisfaction that they are the owner of the mortgage. And that dovetails nicely with the standard mortgage satisfaction forms that the state of Minnesota promulgates for parties to use, because that form says that the party signing the satisfaction is the owner of the mortgage. So this will help literally tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of homeowners where they have a satisfaction, which if they give it to the county recorder, it will be accepted, because the recorder's job isn't to judge the validity of the satisfaction as long as it's properly filled out. They'll accept it for recording, but in the record, if someone did a title examination, they'd say, wait a minute, this is the wrong party signing the satisfaction. And in the case of the Torrens or registered land, it would be rejected, because the registrar does have a job to make sure that it's coming from the right party. And then it goes home and it goes in the drawer and it never gets filed until someone goes to sell or refinance, and then there's a title problem. So this will save a lot of wheel spinning, if you will, finding them, and we, the Bar Association, the Real Property Section, unanimously endorsed this, as has the Minnesota Land Title Association, and others who took a look at it. So we would urge your support.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Burnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I guess there is an amendment. I don't know if you're going to move that one yet. And then secondly, I noticed that the House Research Bill Summary says the principal amount was $500,000, whereas the bill itself says $500,000 or less for the original mortgage. And I guess the question I would have, wouldn't this same problem exist for people like Representative Pugh that have a much higher mortgage than $500,000 you're trying to retire?
I could have the whole block of homes in South St. Paul, Madam Chair, for $500,000. The bill is correct that it would be $500,000 or less. I'm not exactly sure when the Bar Association chose that amount, and perhaps Mr. Parsons could respond to that.
Mr. Parsons.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that number came out of the original certificate of release provisions that the legislature adopted about 7 years ago that permits title companies to satisfy mortgages if they pay them off at a closing. And so we chose that for two reasons. One, we felt it was a way to test the waters and make sure that everything's going to work here. We believe it will, and we'll come back to you in a couple years and ask you to either eliminate that threshold or raise it. But we wanted to test it. And second of all, we felt that given that this is directed towards the historical problem more than the present problem, that is, the mortgage you take out today, you aren't going to pay off tomorrow. Most mortgages that were granted 10 or 15 or 20 years ago were less than $500,000. That's a relatively new phenomenon when it comes to house financing. So we felt that was a reasonable threshold to start with. But it doesn't have any magic significance, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Burnett?
Just kind of one follow-up question. Is there any process right now in law that requires a mortgage company, when it sells, a mortgage to a different company, and I think it happened to me 3 or 4 times in the past 4 or 5 years, to record it, to get a release at that point? Is there anything in law that would require them to do that automatically?
Mr. Parsons.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative, there are two different statutes that require a lender to provide a satisfaction in recordable form when the loan is paid off. And I think you could argue that that means also provide an assignment. The problem is that tracking things down and actually trying to find someone who can answer a question, and if you can imagine all of the mergers and consolidations that have occurred in the banking industry, how many of us can think of a bank that we knew 25 years ago that has the same name today and is the same institution? There's almost none. And so tracking all that down becomes an absolutely impractical problem, and that's one reason we brought this bill to you, so that you don't have to track down those assignments. There is also a new, relatively new entity, which has to do with this amendment that I believe will be offered, called MERS, which has been set up by the mortgage banking and financing industry, which is meant to be the holder of record of all mortgages, so that they can issue satisfactions when the time comes, and you don't have to issue assignments, because they keep track of the ownership, if you will, behind their facade in their electronic records, so that you don't have to know who the ultimate lender is. You just have to know MERS holds the mortgage on the property. So that over time will solve many of these problems. But it doesn't solve the problem for the existing homeowners who have paid off their mortgages and can't get a valid satisfaction.
Any additional questions? Representative Littman.
Chairman Holberg, Mr. Parsons, just very briefly, was it your testimony that putting this in Chapter 507 is sufficient for it to apply to both the Torrens and the abstract properties?
Mr. Parsons.
Madam Chair, Representative Lipman, members of the committee, yes.
Ms. Van Knighten.
Madam Chair, Representative Kuhn, Mr. President, I just noticed, I'm sorry I didn't see it earlier. In the bill, as it was prepared in the revisor's office, if you look at page 2, line 33, you see the effective date. It says this section is effective August 1st, 2004. I think the intent there is that section 1 of the bill, which is essentially the content of the bill, should be have that effective date, but you notice the way it was drafted, it says section 2 effective date, so it's not doing what is intended. All you need to do, if the author would move page 2 to delete line 32, that would take care of it, because the intent is for that sentence about the effective date to be part of section 1.
Representative Peel?
Madam Chair, that is our intention, and I would move whatever remedy is necessary to make it work.
Right, Representative Peel moves that page 2, line 32 be deleted. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion is adopted. Okay, any additional questions on the bill? Representative Peel, you do have an amendment in our packet. It is the 826 amendment. Representative Paul.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize. I walked in a moment late, and maybe you explained this, Mr. Parsons, but could you just tell me, I'm looking at the bottom of page 1, lines 24, 25, what are the damages available to somebody who, if there's a situation of somebody improperly executing a satisfaction, what's the practical meaning of those few lines there?
Well, Mr. Parsons.
Madam Chair, Representative Cole, members of the committee, I think it's really explained later on in the bill in subdivision 4 on the following page. If a satisfaction was erroneously executed, presumably the debt still exists or some portion of the debt. And so the holder of that note in the mortgage under, you know, revised Article 9 would be able to pursue the borrower for the unpaid portion of that debt even though the mortgage had been satisfied.
Okay.
And if there was some negligence involved, maybe they even could pursue a claim against whoever executed it.
Very simple. Thank you. Any additional questions? Representative Peel, do you want to speak to the 0826 amendment?
Sure, Madam Chair. That, and I would move that amendment. This amendment does came to me, Representative Tyson, who will be appearing here later today, maybe up here soon, actually. Brought me this amendment. It relates to a problem that Mr. Parsons referenced, and that is assignments of mortgages are now tracked through an electronic system, and there has been a problem in the recording of documents because the nature of the assignments reference this company as a nominee of the mortgage holder. And the question at the end is, who should sign? This company, the nominee, or the actual mortgage holder? Examiners of title in Hennepin County and in other counties have had difficulty in solving that problem. They have worked with the industry to come up with this amendment, which hopefully solves the difficulty they're having in whether or not to record the satisfaction. Again, a problem for the person that pays off the mortgage, sitting there with a document that may not be recordable, and they may not be able to have clear title on their property. There is present here today Bob Pratt. He's an attorney who works with this industry and would be able to explain better than I the nature of the problem and how this amendment would fix this. But it does relate very much to the topic of the first bill.
Thank you, Representative Pugh. Mr. Pratt, if you'd state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Robert J. Pratt. I'm an attorney with Briggs & Morgan. I represent MERS, which is the Mortgage Electronic Registration Services, which is the organization that Mr. Parsons and Mr. Representative Pugh were referring to earlier today during the hearing. I think that this the problem that we're trying to solve with this amendment is a variation on a theme we were discussing, and the committee had testimony earlier about the volume of mortgage assignments and transfers of interests in mortgages. And with the SNL collapse, we all became acutely aware of that. MERS was started to try to deal with that problem to simplify both for the county recorders and the registrars of titles and for the consumers the handling of transactions involving their residential mortgage loans primarily. And what has evolved is a system where MERS is shown as the mortgagee of record as nominee for the lender. And that language is used because they don't have a 100% beneficial interest in a loan. They're acting as an agent or nominee of the lender, and they are authorized to act with regard to the mortgage instrument. That makes it much simpler down the road when something happens in connection with a mortgage, if it's satisfied or has to be amended, that it only has to be done in the name of MERS. Meanwhile, MERS tracks changes in the beneficial interests that happen to the debt instrument over the life of the loan electronically in their system. What this amendment does is it facilitates primarily for the registrar of titles offices, who are the gatekeepers and who have to make assessments about the nature of the interest in recorded instruments when they take them in for filing. And what this amendment does is it allows them to accept a language, assignment, satisfaction, releases, or whatever that are done in the name of the original mortgagee who is acting as nominee or agent for the primary lender.
Thank you, Mr. Pratt. Representative Pugh, has this amendment been reviewed by the Bar Association, or given that you've started out with a bar bill that's supposed to be non-controversial, do we?
Madam Chair, it has been. I don't know that it went to their formal committee process that culminated in November of last year, but they have reviewed this amendment. They have reviewed the concept. And it's my understanding that they are all right with having it incorporated in the Bar Association real estate bill.
All right. Thank you. Any additional questions on the amendment? Is there anybody in the audience that would like to speak to the 826 amendment? All right. Any additional questions? No. Okay. Representative Pugh renews his motion to adopt Amendment 826. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion 826 is adopted. Now we are into the bill as you would like the bill considered. Are there any additional questions on the bill as amended? No? All right. All right, members, Representative Pugh renews his motion that House File 1805 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate your hearing this, and I expect this bill would probably be a clue to our new staff as to who the attorneys are.
We'll see. The next bill on our agenda is House File 1803, which is Representative De La Forest. Welcome to the committee, Representative De La Forest.
This is my favorite committee, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, colleagues. I'm here today to present House File 1803 on behalf of the Minnesota State Bar Association. I would ask that it be recommended for approval as amended, and I'll get to that in just a moment, and be placed on the General Register. And if I may, Madam Chair,
continue?
I do have one author's amendment, and that amendment would be found on page 8, line 18. That's Article 1, Section 7 of the bill. I'd like to delete the entire Section 7, which would run, as I mentioned, from page 8, line 18 through page 9, line 9. And with that, the bill would be in the proper form. I'd like it for discussion.
Thank you. Representative De La Forest moves to amend House File 1803, page 8, lines 18 through 36 deleted, page 9. Lines 1 through 9 deleted in order to get the bill in the shape that the author would like to discuss this bill. Any questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. As you'll recall, last session some changes were made to Minnesota's probate law. The bill you have here in front of you today is more technical than not in nature and is really viewed as a housekeeping type of bill. I'm proud to have with me here today Bob McLeod, who is the co-chair of the probate section of the State Bar Association, who can explain the changes in detail. But basically, Article 1 concerns making some changes to Minnesota's trust law, while Article 2 deals with some technical changes to Minnesota's guardian and conservatorship laws. And Chapter 3, finally, is the technical of the technical, as they are changes requested by our friends in the revisor's office. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd like to present Mr. McLeod.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. McLeod.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good afternoon, and thank you, members of the committee. Article 1, for clarity, I'm co-chair of the Legislation Committee of the State Bar, the Probate and Trust section, just to be clear.
And members, this is another bar bill?
Yes, this is a bar bill.
Thank you.
Correct. Article 1 is substantially a bill that was passed through this committee last year and was actually approved by vote on the floor of the House last year with one, I think it's just the one addition regarding the ability to remove trustees in some rare circumstances when there's no ability to remove a trustee in a trust and it's trying to fill a gap where that problem exists and it requires court scrutiny before any such thing could happen. Article 2, you might recall last year we completely rewrote the Guardianship Act, completely eliminated the old statutes and adopted a whole set of brand new statutes. And actually, I'm quite pleased with the very few numbers of changes we have to do in that one. They're for the most part technical and for the most part at the request of the county court referees to streamline a couple things and clarify some ambiguities, and I'd be glad to go over them in particular if you like. And then finally, Article 3 relates to the revisor's office deliberately waited until the guardianship bill was fully passed before going after all these technical amendments. And their amendments, the nomenclature of guardianships and conservatorships changed with the new statute, and so did the citations. And so the technical corrections update the nomenclature of guardianships and conservatorships throughout all of our Minnesota statutes and corrects the citations to the new law to the Act throughout these statutes. I'm not sure if there's particular questions on each specific change or while they were done. I don't want to waste the committee's time if there's no specific questions.
All right. Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Representative Wardlow.
I noticed on page 3, line 4, the word must is written twice. Is that there for emphasis? Or
3, line 4?
Representative Wardlow, could you state the page and line?
Page 3, line 4.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, and Representative Wardlow, good eye. That does look like to be a typo in the bill.
Yep. Madam Chair, we've got a new employee for the revisor's office. if there's ever a change in career. But in any case, if Representative Wardlow is moving that as an amendment, I'd certainly accept it as a friendly amendment to the bill.
So moved.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Take care of that in short order. Okay, any other questions? Is there anybody in the audience that would like to speak in opposition to House File 1803? Seeing none, Representative DeLaForest renews his motion that House File 1803, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the House floor or the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
Madam Chair and committee.
Okay, the next item on our agenda today will be House File 1802. Welcome to the committee, Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We'll get Representative Pugh to move approval of House File 1802 to be forwarded to the General Register, I believe. Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a bill brought forward by the Bar Association as well to amend really three sections of our current statutes, 302A, which governs corporations, 322B, which governs limited liability corporations, and 317A, which addresses the nonprofits. With regard to nonprofits, all it does is allow for, with permission, electronic notification of board meetings and such, which is to bring it in conformity with some of our other corporate statutes and also current practice. So that's the only thing that deals with 317A. This is a fairly, there's some fairly technical changes, and it was the result, again, through the Bar Association of a process that included many lawyers representing a variety of practices and perspectives. And really, it was twofold purpose. One is to kind of remove some obstacles to the efficient conduct of corporate affairs. So, for instance, one of the big changes is that it allows conversions from corporations to another form of entity called the LLC. And really what that does is just eliminates several steps and kind of procedural steps and paperwork because it can be done very easily, but you just have to go through the process, and this just makes the process more easy. And the other thing that the proposed legislation does is it really kind of conforms corporate law to the realities of current business practices. So what I'd like to do, if it's all right with the chair, is call down two folks from the Bar Association, Dave Vanderhaar and Lisa Holter.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Dave Vanderhaar. I'm an attorney with Fagree & Benson, and I am the chair of the Business and Professional Corporations section of the Business Law section of the Bar.
Thank you.
I'm Lisa Holter. I'm a lawyer with Fredrickson & Byron. I'm the legislative coordinator for the Business Law section and also participate in the business law committees.
Right, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As Representative Thiessen indicated, this bill does a number of technical changes to 302A and also does some conforming changes to update the statute to reflect changes in the Model Business Corporation Act, which is a model act that's prepared by expert practitioners in the corporate field and is the act in which 302A was originally modeled. It also makes certain procedures such as conversions of LLCs into corporations and corporations into LLCs simpler without really making a substantive change. Madam Chair, we can go through it in some detail or we can answer questions, whatever is the committee's preference.
Right. Ms. Holter, did you have anything that you'd like to add at this time?
No.
Okay, thank you. Members, let's see if we have any questions. Any questions at this time? Representative Littman.
I was just hoping that either Mr. Vanderhaar or Ms. Holter might be able to address the or explain briefly about the plurality voting of members of the Board of Directors.
Certainly, I'd be happy to do that.
Mr. Vanderhaar.
Yes, I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I would be happy to do that, Representative Lippen. Minnesota has long had a rule that provides for a majority vote for directors. One of the potential problems with a majority vote is you can get into a situation where there are no new directors elected. And so the practice in most states now, including Delaware, has been to go to a plurality vote, which would assure that if you have three directors running and you only have two slots, a plurality of the votes for those three directors, two directors, would result in two new directors being elected.
Representative Littman.
Only because I don't practice in this area, Madam Chairman, Mr. Vanderhaar, if you could tell me why the move. It would seem to be an important check, at least the corporate law when I went to law school was is that it was a majority vote, or at least consensus as to who would be put on the board. I'm just wondering whether the board becomes more brittle if you have plurality votes. I'm just wondering why the trend is this way. I don't doubt, mm-hmm. doubt your testimony.
Well, Madam Chair, thank you. Plurality has arisen because there are technical circumstances where you could have, let's say, 60% of the shareholders present there, but not the 50% vote that would require, you would need to get a majority. Okay. But you would have a plurality of the votes, and what it assures is that somebody is elected. If you don't have someone elected, you just wind up with a carryover board. So we think it's a good change, and it wasn't controversial.
Thank you. Representative Teason.
And if I can just add one more thing, I think that's something you can opt out of in the articles as well, if you want to choose for majority vote.
Mr. Vandehaar.
That is correct. You could change that rule. You could leave it a majority if you wanted to.
Representative Lippman?
Now I understand. Thank you.
Right. Any additional questions for the testifiers or for the bill author? Anybody in the audience like to speak to this House file? Seeing none, Representative Pugh renews his motion that House File 1802 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam
Thank
Chair.
You very much. And members of the committee and the audience, we need a special thanks to Mr. Grooms, who scurried around like a mad hatter over the last week getting these three bills ready for the committee. I didn't want to waste a single day, and so he took it upon himself to get these bills ready and work with the bill authors, and we appreciate that because we'd hate to waste a day on this committee. The next bill on the calendar, on the agenda, is House File 898, Representative Teason.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Should we have someone move the bill?
I'd be happy to move House File 898, be recommended to pass and refer to local government.
And there's also an author's amendment.
Would you like me to move that for you at this time?
Thank you.
Members, I'd like to move Amendment 0825 to get the bill in the shape in which the author would like to discuss. Any questions? All those in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Amendment 825 is adopted. Representative Teason.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if I might, just because we're not going to vote on, you are not going to vote on the bill today, there are two other amendments that I've discussed with people that I don't think we need to offer today, but I just want to, just for the record, one is to make clear that this applies only prospectively. So only decisions made by political subdivisions in the future would be affected by this, or would get this remedy. The other relates to MNCOR, which is the prison industry, and exempting them from this bill. But with those two statements, really this bill is, it kind of encapsulates a fairly straightforward concept of fairness, in my opinion. Fundamentally, what it does is it provides compensation to private individuals and businesses under some very specific circumstances. One is where the circumstances where the state or a political subdivision, a city or a county, decides to provide a service that is currently, at the time that they make the decision, being provided by a private person. Secondly, and this is with the amendment, that the state or the subdivision prohibits the private person from performing that business anymore in the jurisdiction, or limits the number of people who can provide the service in such a way that some of the people that are currently providing the service can't provide the service in that jurisdiction anymore. So basically, the state says, we're going to do this, and you can't anymore. And then, as a result of that, there's some additional things that have to be proved related to causation. Basically, that forces you to go out of business. And so that's the fundamental concept. There are some important limitations, I think, that it's important to keep in mind. One, is that if there's a contract or other arrangement currently in place, so if the city has contracted with someone to provide a service, the terms of those of that contract would govern, and not this amendment. This is this legislation would not cover that situation. So, for instance, if someone had contracted with the city to provide a certain service for 2 years, and the city terminates it after 1 year, you'd have a contract remedy, breach of contract remedy, but not an inverse condemnation remedy. The second thing is as you can see from the amendment, it doesn't apply to municipal utilities, which are currently governed by a whole other statutory framework that governs when a municipal utility moves into a different area and takes over the service area of someone else. So we're exempting that. And then I think it's important to emphasize that this doesn't apply when the city or the county or the state is simply competing with another industry. And that raises a lot of other issues, but this bill doesn't address those. It's only when the business is prohibited from doing the business in that subdivision or in that jurisdiction. It's really, again, an issue of basic fairness. This bill doesn't question or control whether and when a government goes into a particular business. It's kind of neutral as to that issue. But if it does, the kind of philosophy underlying this bill that is the government's going in there to provide a public good, and that the cost of providing that public good shouldn't be borne by an individual business disproportionately, but it should be spread over, in this case, typically the taxpayers of the jurisdiction that makes the decision. So it really is a kind of an issue of fairness and how are we going to, you know, pay for the political and governmental decisions that we make. I guess I do have a few witnesses that would like to testify. I'd first like to have Mr. Mark Stoltman.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Stoltman. If you'd state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
My name is Mark Stoltman. I'm the general manager of Randy's Sanitation. We're a business based in Delano with locations in Burnsville and Rogers. Thank you, Representative Thiessen. Madam Chair, I'm here before you today to ask for the committee and your support on the House File 898, Just Compensation. Just compensation, in my mind, is a fairness issue, as earlier said, but primarily it's an important issue because it's about people or companies being potentially put out of business by political subdivisions within the state. The fairness issue comes in based upon the fact that over the course of many years, haulers or the hauling community bases their business on relationships that they build over the course of time. Those relationships are based upon good services at fair prices. When we get into a situation whereby a political subdivision has the ability or the right to come in and indicate that they want to do business within an area we service, we're put into a position where it not only hurts the companies that are immediately affected by the taking, but any other companies, such as the company I manage, that may want to grow within that area. And that growth is potentially forevermore not something that we can do. There's a difference in small businesses versus large, and we happen to be a small one. We look at things, and right now we participate in collection services in a wide variety of areas, but very carefully try and budget what we do based upon the resources that we have. We don't have stockholders or anything of that nature. So when we work at trying to determine our business plan, we look at how much we can afford to spend at any given time on trucks, which are $150,000 to $200,000 a piece, or the carts that you would use to service a particular route that truck would pick up, which would cost you about $20,000. And as we budget that equipment, we have to keep every bit of it working to just keep our heads above water. When you take a political subdivision that may want to take business that we have within a county, let's assume it's a city like Maple Grove where we have several thousand customers, we couldn't afford to compete in that area if they wanted to award that to one hauler because it may be a community of 20 or 25,000 homes, and we just don't have the political or the financial resources to the capital available to just jump in and compete for that business. So we're precluded from doing that. So we not only lose the business, never have a chance at it, we just plain and simply don't have the money to go there. The smaller haulers than us never get an opportunity to bid on these things. In fact, many haulers over the course of time and the pressure that we've been under for the past several years by cities and counties that threaten us with the opportunity to take our business, many of them have sold. They're not in business anymore. There's been dozens and dozens of companies that just either don't have the money to compete or don't have the time. They're busy on the trucks. They're busy day-to-day just performing the services of the business. And those people are already gone. I believe that people like the company I manage are here to, frankly, competition's good. It keeps prices stable. It, through the course of us working harder and harder each day to service the community and find better ways of doing things, I think we keep the system honest, and I think it's important to have us. We live in a highly regulated and very competitive industry, and if we work smarter each month, day, month, and year, and market right and defend against marketing that comes, you know, from every angle, we may have an opportunity to stay in business and grow our business. We comply with all federal, state laws. If we do everything right, the owners of my company hope to be able to pass this business on to their five sons who are currently working there. I can compete with I don't care who it is, biggest companies to smallest companies, but I can't compete with the ability of a political subdivision to come in and take my business. I can't do that. I have no recourse there. It's important to me, and it's important to some of the members, all of the members I'm here with today, that we look at this in that fashion and we remember that most of the companies, such as the one I work for, pour all of their spare dollars and resources back into the company. This is their retirement plan. This is the future of their families. We employ 135 people, and they all depend on us performing well. I think we do that, if we're allowed to. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Stoltman? Thank you very much. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Burrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, maybe my question is for Representative Tyson. And I may direct a question to Mr. Stoltman as we move on. You said this would not apply if the municipality competes. So if a city like Maple Grove hires their own drivers and buys their own garbage trucks and drives a hauler out of the area, they wouldn't have any recourse under this bill?
Representative Tyson.
Yes, that's correct.
Representative Burrell.
The hauler would have to, or the city, excuse me, or the county would have to actually say, we are going to do this. That's one scenario, and no one else can. Or, if there's four haulers in Maple Grove, I mean, the situation that he was talking about, where they're competing, and then the city were to say, we only want two haulers here. And there may be legitimate, I don't know, reasons for that, I don't know. But if that, in that case, the two haulers, if there were four before and there's two left, the two haulers who are essentially prohibited from going forward would be entitled to compensation. So there's kind of a whole spectrum of possible scenarios. If the city were just say, we're going to put our trucks on the street, but you can go and compete for the customers just like we can, this bill wouldn't address that. Would not address that.
Representative Burrell.
Okay, I think I understand. Just so I'm clear that if the city, like in a case of a municipal liquor store, would say, we're going to be now the exclusive liquor wholesaler, liquor retailer in this municipality, and that drove private businesses out, they would have no recourse. But if they said, we're going to put in a municipal liquor store and we're going to compete for a retail liquor business, then there might be a...
I think it's...
Representative
Tyson. Oh, I'm sorry, Madam Chair. And Representative Burrell. I think it's actually the reverse, that if the municipality said, we're going to have exclusive municipal liquor stores in whatever city, then the people that currently have potentially, the people that have the liquor stores there who are driven out of business, they would have a claim here. If the municipality just said, we're going to open a municipal liquor store, but you can go ahead and continue to sell liquor, you know, operate your liquor store, in that circumstance, while that does raise some concerns with subsidies and variety of issues, that wouldn't be addressed by this bill. They would not have a claim.
Thank you. Representative De La Forest. Yes,
Madam Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Burrell.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I had another direction I wanted to go.
Certainly.
Representative Tyson, if we have these new tax-free zones and because of a business that moves in right across the street, I'm not in the tax-free zone, but this municipal business or other business is there any action against the state for me not being able to compete in a tax-free zone?
Representative Easton.
I mean, the way that I would conceive of this is that if the state prohibited you from going into business within the jurisdiction of the state, that's when this would apply to the state. Whether a tax-free zone is a jurisdiction for purposes of this bill, I haven't thought. I would say no, it wouldn't apply, but I haven't thought that all the way through.
Representative
Burrell.
Madam Chair, I just recommend that we think that through a little bit on page 1, so it says directly or indirectly has effect on the goods and services that businesses are able to provide.
Let me explain that. Let me explain that language. What that directly or indirectly goes to is there's a couple of different situations where this occurred. One is, for instance, in the garbage hauling situation, the city could buy the trucks and provide the service. That's directly. The other way they could do is say, the city is going to be the provider of garbage hauling services, but we're going to enter into a contract with Company A to do it. That would be the indirect provision of the services. And that's kind of what that language is intended to do.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative De La Forest.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Thiessen, I just had a quick question regarding the public policy. The little knowledge I have in the background of this bill seems to be centered on the waste management business and some of the issues that some haulers have faced in dealing with municipalities. But with some exceptions, the sweep of your bill is much broader than that. And is it your intent that this bill would apply to other endeavors outside of waste management? And if so, is it more of a philosophical matter for you of the public policy, or are there other specific industries that have been affected by a municipality limiting market entry in certain ways?
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative De La Forest. It is more of a philosophical approach to it, so I don't have any other particular industry thoughts in mind, but I think that the principle, which we've seen in the waste hauling area, would apply and should apply equally in other situations where a government would take that step of entering the business and prohibiting others from doing it to the detriment of a private business. So,
thank you. Any additional questions at this time? Representative Lutland, I'm sorry.
That's fine, Madam Chairman. I've had a chance. Chairman Holberg, Representative Thiessen, I guess I had a couple of questions. Two on 825, the 825 amendment, and two on 898. If I could do the amendment first, and I get where you're going with this legislation. I'm just I have some questions about the drafting. I'm just wondering whether, looking at lines 5 through 7 of the 825 amendment, whether a license, the city licenses an entity, could be construed as a, quote, limit on the number of persons who are permitted to provide a good or service within the jurisdiction.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Lippman. I would say that it would, in the circumstance where they reduce the number of licenses. Now, that said, you also have to look to the contract limitation, which is subdivision 2. So I think that language would apply in that situation. But if the license, you know, was set forth the terms under which they were going to be able to operate, so it said you can operate here, which typically is how a license worked, but for 2 years, you would have a remedy under that license as opposed to under this provision, if that makes sense. So I think that the language you're pointing to would cover it, except that where there are these terms and conditions that govern the operation, I think in that circumstance you'd have a remedy there, but not necessarily under this act, this remedy provision.
Oh, okay. Just
Representative Lippman.
Chairman Holbrook, Representative Heason, just so I understand your testimony, I'm trying to follow it, which is if City A has a has 100 licenses for X and so activity, let's use an example of, you know, medallions for cab drivers. Lake Elmo doesn't have it, but it, you know, we issue medallions for cab drivers, and suddenly we move from 100 to 20 for whatever public purpose. We're tired of the cabs driving around, you know, want fewer cabs. Would the 80 who are put out have a cause of action to condemn the market value of a cab medallion in Lake Elmo?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think the answer, and my last answer is probably convoluted, I think the answer would be no, with the caveat that the, and I just don't know enough about cab medallions, but that there's terms and conditions that would say you have this for a year and your expectation shouldn't be beyond a year. And so when you have that expectation, the idea with that contract exemption is that you're making your plans and decisions, financial and otherwise, based on your assessment of whether you're going to be able to renew that or not.
Representative, so if I understand you, which is they can change the number of licenses, they can't do a taking. That's what you're saying. Once you have the expectation for 2 years, they can't come in and obliterate you, but at the end of the 2 years, they could reduce the number of licenses.
Madam Chair, yes.
Okay. So I understand that. Also with the 825 amendment, Chairman Holbrook, Representative Thiessen, is utilities a term of art? My question is that anything that a municipality wanted to do if it was to be a market venture, this is the popcorn utility, you know, because popcorn is an important public good for city residents, and we're going to provide low-cost popcorn.
Representative Thiessen.
Madam Chair, Representative Lippman, and your comment about the drafting is probably well taken, since this is exactly my I just put this down yesterday.
Okay.
Quickly.
Okay.
There is a statute that governs municipal utilities and provides for provides a mechanism for circumstances where a municipal utility overtakes some other utility's area. Since we're going to lay this over, we'll deal with that issue and define it properly going forward. But that's a good point.
Wondering who can qualify.
Representative Lippman.
Chairman Holmer, just very briefly, turning to 898, and I guess I have some questions about lines 13 through 15. The first, with regards to directly or indirectly, you've addressed Representative Thiessen beforehand, but I'm just wondering whether other language that you might, that I think might work better would be, instead of directly or indirectly, which seems fairly vague, whether you might consider with its own employees or by contract.
And that,
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that probably covers the concept, and since we're going to lay this over, and there seems to be concern about that, we'll work on some language to make it clear.
I guess I would urge you in that direction. Finally,
Representative Lippman.
Madam Chairman, Representative Thiessen, on line 15, I'm just looking at previously, I wish I had a better example or a good example with regards to that, but I know that you have in mind the condemnation during the period of expectation, which is we had a contract or we have current customers and the city comes in and blots them out. But I'm just wondering whether that's time delimited, you know, which is way back in the olden times we were doing X and so business. We haven't done it in modern times, but now I want the city to buy my business.
Representative Thiessen.
Madam Chair and Representative Lippman, and this one was actually brought up to me previously. I think you raised this. And it may be that I think that that's a correct point, and I think we may use words like contemporaneous with the decision or something to make it clear. But that's, thank you. We'll deal with that again before the next hearing.
Any additional questions before we continue with testimony? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Representative Thiessen.
Madam Chair. Thanks a lot. George Walters.
Mr. Walters, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is George Walter. I'm from Walters Recycling and Refuse in Blaine, Minnesota.
I'm living through a situation right now in my business, in one of the communities that I haul is the city of Lauderdale. And the city of Lauderdale has approximately 500 residential homes in the community, and I pick up about 280 to 300 of them. I've been doing business in that community for approximately 15, 20 years. And the city right now is moving forward with a proposal to take all of those customers sort of under their wing and become the customers of the city. And currently there's three haulers in that community, and they want to take and just have one hauler do the whole entire city. So that in a sense, they're going to basically issue those houses or my customers to whatever hauler they choose. And this has been going on for probably 10 months now, and we've been negotiating with the city trying to come to some kind of resolution. And one of their main reasons why they want to do this is because they just rebuilt all the streets in the community. And they're telling us that they believe that by taking two of us out, basically there's three trash trucks that pick up in the community, by eliminating two trucks out of the community, that they're gonna get more wear and tear and more life out of their streets. So I asked them the question, well, you know, what's the average life of your streets in your community? By taking two trucks out of there, is your street gonna last 20 years or 20 years and one extra month because two trucks are taken off the street? But we don't get any response out of them. And I ask them questions about, well, what about the rest of the businesses that use the streets in the community? UPS, FedEx, Home Depot, Menards. I mean, they've got trucks driving in and out of the community too. Why are you singling out us and making the waste industry liable for the wear and tear of your streets? I think this is a fairness issue. I think if Mr. Stoltman indicated before, these trash trucks are $150,000 to $200,000, and I'm a small family run company competing against some huge worldwide corporations, and I've got bank loans out there that I got to be responsible for, and all of a sudden the local government comes in and just takes those accounts to make the mortgage payments or the bank payments on those, and that's pretty challenging when I don't get reimbursed for anything. If the trend continues and more communities go like that, a guy like me is going to be out of business because I just can't compete in that environment. So I think you should take this law into consideration, and I'd appreciate your help on it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Walters. Are there any questions for Mr. Walters? Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question, in that one city, how many employees would lose their jobs, or would they? Or?
Well, it
Mr.
takes
Walters.
Us... I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. It's about one day's worth of work. I have one driver in there doing one day's worth of work. I mean, it's not a big community, but sometimes these things start a domino effect. Neighboring communities like Falcon Heights and Roseville, I do a lot of work, and if they switched, I would lose a couple of drivers and a couple of trucks out of the park.
Thank you. Representative Lippman.
Chairman Hofer, Mr. Walters, if it's not a trade secret, maybe you can tell me where you tip. Is it at a transfer station, or do you take it directly to a landfill?
I'm sorry. Got to get used to the climate here. We are using the county processing facilities for some of the waste. Some of the waste we're hauling out of state. We've got a real good working relationship with Ramsey, Washington County. They produce approximately 600,000 tons of waste a year in those two counties, and their processing facility can handle about 450,000 tons. So they've got excess waste in those communities that they need help with to move someplace else, and we run a transfer station, so we haul some of it out of state.
Thank you. Mr. Walters, do you have any licensure agreement with the city or contract? Do you have to register or
Madam Chair, we buy a license to haul in that community. Each city has licenses for the waste industry, and then we obviously have a county license, city license. But we don't have any contract or any written agreement with the municipality. Basically, it's just an open market, so we compete, knock on doors, try to solicit customers, and try to compete against, you know, a lot of our competitors out there. But there's no written contract, no, with the city.
And do you, is that a one-year renewable license, or do you know the terms of it?
Yes, 1 year.
All right. Any additional questions? Representative Burrell.
Madam Chair, along that line, could not, even if we pass House File 898 into law, could not the city just deny you a license next time you're up for renewal and you're out of business anyway without any restitution?
Mr. Walters, or Representative Thiessen.
Yeah, and thank you, Madam Chair. And again, I think that comes down to how the terms are set forth for the license. And since I don't know enough, unfortunately, maybe we can revisit this when we come back again next week, because I don't know the terms and conditions and how that actually, unfortunately, I'm not prepared on that issue. So if it's okay with the Chair, we can take that up next time.
Certainly. Any additional questions for Mr. Walters? Thank you, Mr. Walters.
Thank
Representative
you.
Thiessen, I believe you have one other testifier, Mr. Williamson.
Yes, thank you, Madam.
And we have a number of people who want to testify in opposition to your bill as well.
Thanks.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Williamson, if you'll state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Don Williamson and members of the committee. I own West Central Sanitation, located in more rural Minnesota, about 100 miles west of here. My wife and I operate that, and I've owned it for 25 years. 6 years ago, something a little different twist on this happened to us, in that for about 15 years since we had started business, we hauled garbage and recyclables, and we transported the majority of our recyclables that we collected from business places and residents to a sheltered workshop or handicap workshop, which is quite common in different parts of the state. And the county supported and endorsed that workshop, and so we would just deliver our recyclables there gratis. It was just our part of it. We provided the collection, they would provide the further processing and market it, and the county would then retain those monies. What happened about 6 years ago was a new competitor came to our area of the market and began to collect recyclables, sell their trash service, and then keep the recyclables, market them themselves, which allowed them to subsidize their trash business, and I began to lose customers because of it. That's fine. That's the competitive system. My problem is something that I had to react to that market change. And what we did is I called the county solid waste officer, and I told him about this new blip in the horizon and that something had to change. I could no longer deliver something of value, give it away to the sheltered workshop, and the county could receive all the proceeds. And so he said, well, don't worry about it. Nothing. Don't worry about it. We can't give you anything for it. Well, I know they were getting $95 a ton for the cardboard, and we had to do something. So as we continued to lose customers, I finally gave the county 90-day notice, written notice, and I stated that if we can't come to some agreement and get some value out of the recyclables, that we would have to take matters in our own hand and process them ourselves so that we could keep our business. So we weren't losing our business to the county, but what happened is 90 days went by, nothing happened. We kept our word. We quit delivering recyclables to the county. No response from the county. 2 weeks went by. He came to my office, sat in my office, and he said, I want those recyclables back on our floor, and I want them back by Monday. I said, or else I'm buying trucks and I'm putting you out of business. And I was forced to negotiate with him. And we did work out some kind of compromise where within a few years we were able to salvage our business in that market, keep it alive. We did continue. We wanted to bring the recyclables to the county sheltered workshop. Our problem was I couldn't compete on a different uneven playing field. And the county couldn't seem to understand that. They thought I should just continue to give it to them when my competitor didn't. We worked it out, but to this day, my contracts that I now have with the county always have in there that they reserve the right to have public collection any given year. And so now a business I've built for 25 years, I always have to live under that constant pressure of if I look wrong or if I don't do exactly what they want, my business may be lost. And that's just something that I frankly, I don't feel it's fair. I don't mind competing against competitors, but it's really hard to compete against the government when they have an unfair advantage that I don't have. And then lastly, because of the sake of time, I would just like to state that now what's going on in the 17 counties in southwestern Minnesota are talking about putting a new incinerator down in Redwood County area. And one of their methods in their toolkits to ensure that waste gets there is public collection. And that's a large part of the area in which we serve, in which we serve the public. And that has me quite nervous when I start hearing public collection to ensure that waste gets to that incinerator, when we already are delivering to the many landfills throughout that southwest area that are publicly and privately held already.
Thank you, Mr. Williamson. Are there any questions of Mr. Williamson? All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. I have Keith Carlson, Dave Wierens, Dan Fries, and Tom Glentoff are on my list for opposition. Mr. Carlson? Welcome to the committee, Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Metropolitan Intercounty Association, whose membership consists of 12 of the larger counties in the state of Minnesota, 5 within the Twin Cities metro area, and 7 outstate of those counties with the larger cities in the state. Before I start here, I want to make a couple introductory comments. First, my member counties, and I don't think counties in general, are in the business of going into competition with private business. In fact, quite the opposite. I don't think it's well known, but much of the services that we provide has frequently required by you, we really do under contractual arrangements with the private sector, both for-profit and non-profit entities. And in fact, we've been increasing that practice. Home health care workers has previously in some counties been a county employee function, but many counties are getting out of that business. Again, we are not in the business of providing something that could be more effectively or efficiently provided. Second issue I want to make before I get to my specific comments is much of the discussion you've been hearing today is about organized hauling at the city level. And there are certainly issues there that I can't specifically speak to. The issues I want to speak to is the issues relating to organized hauling at the county level. The fact of the matter is, in reality, with the exception of possibly 2 counties where this practice has been longstanding, I don't know of any county right now that is threatening to do organized hauling. But however, that potential always exists with good reason. Frankly, roughly a little over 15 years ago, you, the legislature, put us into the business of doing solid waste management. That is our responsibility. You have mandated us to go into the business of resource recovery. You have mandated that we provide the opportunity for recycling for our citizens. And we have obliged by making investments in literally in the millions of dollars for including building RDF facilities, building incinerators, and so on. And now we have an obligation to the bondholders who gave us the capital to build those facilities, to the operator of those facilities to meet our contractual obligations to them, to the public utilities who buy either the RDF or the energy that is produced by those facilities, and finally to our taxpayers to manage those as efficiently as possible. And the bottom line is that in order to do that effectively is we have to provide a guaranteed waste stream to that facility. If we don't, it becomes economically unviable because we don't have enough revenues to pay off the bonds, and we cannot meet our contractual obligations with the operators or the public utilities because we, in effect, agree to provide them X amount of product in terms of energy or RDF every day, every month, every week, every month, every year. Flow control or the potential of doing that is something that we need to facilitate doing that. So our concerns with this bill is that it penalizes counties for doing what you mandate us to do. To fulfill the mandates, as I said, we've invested literally millions of dollars in these facilities and entered into long-term contracts with the operators as well as the public utilities that buy either the RDF or the energy that we generate. And I think, frankly, in meeting the mandate from you, we have been successful in reducing the utilization of landfills and providing among the highest level of recycling in the nation, as well at the same time substantially reducing the potential for groundwater contamination. That hasn't come without a cost. We've had to make, as I said, long-term commitments to pay off the bondholders, to have made long-term contractual arrangements with the operators of those facilities when we're using third parties, and with the utilities that buy the fuel or the energy that's produced at these facilities. And we've also imposed substantial costs on our taxpayers that has the result of certain court decisions have had to subsidize these facilities probably far more than we anticipated when they were originally built. The bottom line is there was a court decision a number of years ago that said that our previous ability that by ordinance would allow us to direct all refuse haulers or a significant portion of the refuse haulers to dump at our facilities, we lost that under a challenge under the Interstate Commerce Clause. So once we lost that, the only way we can get these haulers to dump at our facilities is either to provide financial incentives, which we have, but at significant cost to both our and your taxpayers because you are providing some subsidies for us in this area, or by using the potential of organized hauling to get the haulers to continue to come, continue to our facility. Loss of that potential of using organized hauling could be extremely costly to us. It could make these facilities totally financially unviable. We would essentially either default on the bonds for those facilities or our taxpayers would have to step up and pay off the total cost of those bonds rather than a portion of it right now. Counties, as I've said, don't want to go into business or compete with private industry. And in fact, again, I'll emphasize, I don't know of any county that does not have organized hauling right now. And like I said, those two that I know of, Stearns and Grant, have done that. It's been of long standing, and I don't believe that's an issue with any of the haulers. I don't know of any other counties that are threatening to go into it at this time. But again, in our desire, our need to provide a constant flow of materials to these facilities to maintain their financial viability, we have to have the potential of requiring organized hauling to continue the financial viability of those facilities.
Mr. Carlson, I'm going to have to ask you to wrap it up. Okay. We're going to be done by 4 o'clock today.
Madam Chair, to conclude, I think House File 898 is a bill that's basically a solution that's searching for a problem. Again, I don't know of any county that right now is threatening to impose organized hauling. And I guess the final comment I want to make is, although all the focus has been on the impact on the waste industry, this bill has been acknowledged by much of the other presenters, has much, much wider implications. As I've already said, most of the health and social services that we provide right now are done by third parties, and we're very happy with that model of the delivery. But in those instances where we're potentially getting gouged by the only provider of a certain service, say for services to victims of traumatic brain injuries, or that the service is mediocre, we always have the option of bringing those services in-house. If you enact this bill, that option really goes out the window for us. And I strongly recommend you vote against it. Thank you very
much. Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Representative Levin, did you have a brief question for Mr. Carlson?
I was just trying to understand the definition of organized hauling, because some of the things I understood you to say would have violated the rule in the Carbone case, which you also mentioned. What do you mean by organized hauling?
Madam Chair, Representative Lipman, it could take several forms, but the most obvious model is that we enter into a contractual arrangement with one or a number of haulers to provide services to a set geography within our jurisdiction, and as part of that contract that they deliver all their waste or a specified portion of that waste to our facilities.
Representative Lipman.
And it's your understanding that kind of regime is constitutional?
Mr. Chairman, as long as we're entering into it via a contract with the haulers, I don't see that it runs afoul of Carbone. Again, the provisions of the contract is we are granting them, in effect, a franchise to service that area, and has a price of entering into that arrangement. They promise to deliver X amount of product to our tipping facilities.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Mr. Warens from the Association of Minnesota Counties. If you try and conform your remarks to the bill and the elements of the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'll try to keep my name is Dave Warens with the Association of Minnesota Counties, and I'll try and keep my comments brief and not duplicate any of the comments made by Mr. Carlson. Perhaps just an additional response to Representative Lipman's question. The issue involving flow control and ordinance collection is that as long as the county is a market participant, organized collection is legal under the constraints of that decision made back in 1994. And organized collection, under Minnesota law, the counties in effect own the waste and therefore are a participant in the market, and that would be legal under federal law, is my understanding of how that works. That's been part of the issue in the past. Regarding this particular bill, I guess at the Association of Minnesota Counties, we are formally opposed to this bill, and we would encourage the committee to not allow it to go forward in its current form. If you look at the folks who testified in support, they're all solid waste management professionals in the state of Minnesota. And if that is the issue this bill is intended to get at, and the author himself stated he has no other industry in mind when he thinks of this bill and how it might be applied, I'd be much more comfortable in representing counties and discussing this issue as a solid waste policy before the Environment Committee, where perhaps it truly belongs. But I think it's something to the way the bill is certainly structured. There are a few activities of government that are hard to imagine cannot be impacted by this legislation, because there are so many activities that government does that does have a private sector corollary out there, that sometime in the future there could be an impact on the provision of service by the government and by counties. To speak more specifically to the waste issue that's front and center on this bill, the reasons why counties are engaged and why the state has made mandates for us to do certain things with waste management is because the private sector has not entered into these activities. If they're not profitable, the private sector has shown an unwillingness to take care of these issues. Landfilling still is cheaper than resource recovery and landfill abatement, and therefore landfills are the primary method chosen by the private sector. If you look at the facilities in the state of Minnesota, every processed facility that creates energy out of waste were all began by the public sector in direct response to the metropolitan area, a state mandate to process all waste before landfilling, or in greater Minnesota, in the effort to fully implement the requirements of the state waste management hierarchy, which places landfilling of waste at the lowest level of the priority scale. And resource recovery is above that. The other thing I've encouraged the committee to think about, moving away from the waste issues, is just to think about how this bill might have a chilling effect on privatization efforts. As Mr. Carlson stated, counties are not in the business of undertaking activities that are better provided by the private sector. But certainly the problem that occurs here is that to the extent that moving an activity into the private sector is desirable, what this bill would provide is to go back into to unprivatize, the experiment fail for every reason, would have that government have to come to buy that service back from the provider at that point in time. And it's that sort of chilling effect on innovation that I think is contrary to the interest of the state and to the people of Minnesota. Madam Chair, with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. And again, would encourage all of your opposition to this bill, or again, at the very least, to narrow its focus on the waste issues and send it to the Environment Committee for their discussion and consideration.
All right. Thank you. Representative DeLaForest.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Wyers, I have a twofold question. They're kind of diametrically opposed to each other. First of all, you mentioned, and you're correct, that with respect to recycling, there is a higher cost involved. I mean, I believe that the public policy believes that it's a public good, and therefore the taxpayers should subsidize it. And therefore, if this bill were to move forward, couldn't we consider these inverse condemnation proceedings yet one more cost of providing the public good? And second, the other part of my question is that, there's no doubt that there are also certain municipal enterprises or local government enterprises that are in it, not because it's a public good, but because, indeed, there's a profit. I think liquor stores come to mind. And wouldn't this bill be helpful, at least from the political perspective of some, that maybe it would help get government out of some businesses it ought not to be into in the first place?
Mr. Burns.
Ma'am,
nice
Chair.
Easy question for you.
those are always the best questions. It really tests us up here, make us think twice of coming to the table. I think to answer both of your questions, there was an amendment that I had drafted and brought to the attention of Representative Thiessen that would make it clear that if a county or government entity is undertaking an activity to comply with a state law, that'd be exempt from this bill, and that was a proposal that he did not accept. But that is the center point of our interest. The issues of liquor stores, I don't believe there is a county in the state that provides a service like that or owns and operates a liquor store, and I could be missing the point on that.
Well, the LMC wasn't here to pick on. If they're here, I'll ask them.
Well, they're coming.
Yeah, they're coming. But so I think most of the county issues, I believe, if we could exempt activities undertaken to comply with state law, be it solid waste or whatever the case might be, this bill presents far less of an issue for counties because most of our issues are driven by state laws, when state law, in fact, tells us to do. I will allow Mr. Grundhoff with League of Cities to respond to the second part of your question.
All right, thank you. Representative Thiessen.
Just briefly, Madam Chair, thank you. On that amendment, I think that the point that Representative DeLaForest made with regard to this is the correct one, and that is we have chosen as a state to pursue this kind of a public good, and the people of the state should pay for that public good, not individual businesses. That's kind of the essential point of the bill. Now, perhaps the legislature should think more clearly about the mandates that they put on counties, and hopefully in the future we can maybe do that more appropriately or fund it through the state if that's the more appropriate way to do it. But I think the bottom line is essentially the question is how are we going to pay for this public good? Are we going to pay for it through by the taxpayers or imposing that unduly on an individual business?
Ma'am, just a brief response. I think the issue here is that the mandates in solid waste that counties are responsible for were enacted in a time where counties had more tools to control garbage, which equals controlling the money to pay for these public good that are required under state law. There is no recycling program in the state of Minnesota that makes a net profit. The recycling requires a subsidy as a matter of course. As mentioned, we lost flow control authority. All we have left to make sure that these state mandates are complied with and are met is through flow control or at least the threat of flow control. We need to negotiate with haulers to get garbage to certain destinations. And it could be the case, you could say, that adding this cost of compensation as part of the cost of doing business, but again, we have an environment in the state of Minnesota where paying taxes is not a positive thing, and paying fees is not a good thing as well. And it becomes a matter of balancing the competing interests out there and how the public good is to be achieved.
Thank you very much. I also have Mr. Fries from MinCor.
I think they may have left after. We're going to, after exemption.
Okay, and then Mr. Grunhofer from the League of Minnesota Cities. Welcome to the committee. If you'd like to start with Representative DeLaForest's question first.
Could you restate that question?
Representative DeLaForest.
I was just curious, Mr. Grunhofer, that obviously we have these two kinds of enterprises. One seems to be provided not for money-making purposes, but to provide a public good. And then we have others that it seems apparent to me are there because they're revenue generators, and immediately a municipal liquor store came to mind. I mean, they generally make money. And my question was, isn't this bill a good thing because then it will cause some units of government to stop providing what the public sector could be providing and should be providing, quite frankly?
Mr. Grunhofer, if you
like
say your name for the record and then take a swing at Representative DeLaForest's question.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Grunhofer. I'm the General Counsel of the League of Minnesota Cities, and I would like to thank Mr. Wyrens for passing this question on to me. Historically, I mean, if we're talking about municipal liquor stores, historically, municipal liquor stores weren't established for the purpose of generating revenue. They were established for the purposes of controlling, regulating liquor sales in this state. Some municipal liquor stores make monies, others don't. And I think it's hard-pressed to say that necessarily private enterprise would step in the absence of a municipal liquor operation. In some cases, that would be the case. In others, it wouldn't be the case. I know that doesn't directly respond to your question, but
Would it be safe to say that the League of Minnesota Cities considers it something that municipalities should provide if I, you know, I live in a particular part of the state that can't get beer? that seems to be the logical extension of your answer.
No, I mean,
I can see the city fire. We can't get a 12-pack.
One of the reasons of
it would be.
Yes. No, I mean, in some parts of the state, cities do step in the absence of market conditions, not just in municipal liquor stores, in the area of golf courses, swimming pools, those kinds of sorts of operations. But it is an individual community kind of decision. They have to decide what's best for their particular communities.
Thank you.
Thank you. And if you'd like to briefly
speak to
the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to thank Representative Tyson for the opportunity. He did contact us last week, asked our input into the bill, and I appreciate that. And we do appreciate the amendments that he put forward today and is thinking about for next week, because in an objective state, they do narrow the scope of this bill and do address many of the concerns that we had with this bill. However, saying that, we still do oppose this particular piece of legislation for several different reasons. First, as we've already talked about today, several years ago, this legislature passed a law, 115A.94, which specifically, if not encouraging organized collection, it certainly allows it, recognizing that it is a policy of the state that organized collection in certain situations is a good thing. And what this bill does is effectively eliminate and put a disincentive to organized collection in our communities. A number of communities think that organized collection, eliminating the number of garbage haulers in a community, has a number of positive effects for the citizens of those communities. They believe, and there will be testimony later on if necessary, that it does improve service to the citizens of cities. It can lessen costs. And perhaps more importantly, it does minimize the impact on city roadways. There's probably no less significant weight-bearing trucks that come into our communities than garbage hauling facilities. And to have that happen every single morning on a given cul-de-sac does result in wear and tear on streets. And it is reasonable that cities would think that organized collection and limiting, put some limit on the number of trucks that are running in the communities, is a reasonable thing. Now, people can differ on that, but this legislature did pass the organized collection bill a number of years ago and said that is a reasonable thing for cities to think about. If they don't want, if that's no longer the policy of the state, then I think a discussion on the viability of organized collection is more the proper subject of debate than this sort of, I think, large solution to a particular problem is involved. If this bill does pass, I think it will, in effect, if the intent is to restrict organized collection, I think it will do that. In addition, in the comments that we made to Representative Tyson, this bill will precipitate litigation against cities, counties, townships, anybody, any local government unit that is doing anything that sort of touches or affects or competes in some way, shape, or form with private sector activities. And if the goal is to precipitate litigation, well, then I think this legislation will do that. And for those reasons, we encourage this committee to not pass this.
All right. Thank you. Members, we have one more individual would like to testify, and Mr. Doyle, if you'd like to stand, we are going to conclude by 4 o'clock. This bill will be laid on the table. I suggest others that want to address this issue contact the chief author, and he's most agreeable to try and work out as much of this as possible. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is O.J. Doyle, and I generally deal with the Health Policy and Finance Committee, so this is somewhat of a different experience for me. The Ambulance Association is made up of public, private, paid, volunteer ambulance services throughout the state, and my concern is that, frankly, I don't understand what the potential ramifications are for the ambulance industry as it's currently established in Minnesota. It's a system that's been in place for 20 years, has worked fine until recently. There's been interest in some communities of starting up their own ambulance services for a variety of reasons, and doing that could have a very disruptive effect on the public health. At least that's the way we feel. And we're concerned that somehow or other this may enter into that very complicated, long-winded discussion, and it's an issue that is hopefully unrelated to this. I'm not an attorney, so I contacted 6 attorneys today. I spoke with them trying to get their view on whether I was right or wrong. 3 said that they agreed with me, and 3 said this would be great for us. So I guess my request is if you could exempt the ambulance services from this bill, we can just walk away from the fight.
Mr. Doyle, thanks for coming to the committee. And in the interest of the time, and because it's your first time here, I'm not going to let anybody ask you any questions today. Come back in a week at your own risk. But thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
I would like to move to place House File 898 on the table. And members, we will not have a committee meeting tomorrow as they are urging us all to attend the bioscience program. We are scheduled for a meeting a week from today, next Tuesday. And I'd also like to caution you that if you've been approached by lobbyists about carrying particular bills for this committee, the sooner the better. I'm not going to be real happy if we're going to spend a Saturday here around committee deadline, and I don't like meetings at midnight either, so get moving. I've got time on my committee schedule for next Tuesday. So, again, Representative Thiessen, thank you for coming to the committee. We will see you next week, and the meeting's adjourned.